Hello and welcome to Will You Still Love It Tomorrow? I'm Dave.
And I'm Annie. Each month we take it in turns to nominate a film, TV show or book we were a fan of before we were married and that the other one doesn't really know.
Then we both watch or read it and come together to discuss our reactions. Fair warning, there will be spoilers.
This month I was very apprehensive when Dave chose the 1983 movie The Dead Zone. So, how did this get on the list?
That's a very good question, which I do not have an answer.
So, I mean, you must have watched it before.
Oh, certainly, I watched it a long time ago. I'm sure it came up in conversation somehow and got put on the list at some point, but it was so long ago, I'm afraid I do not recall exactly how it got there. I know why I picked it for this episode, but I can't remember how it got on the list in the first place. So, we've been doing a lot of big, epic fantasy stuff recently. Listeners, if you happen to have randomly come to this episode as your first instance of our podcast, you really must go listen to the episode on Hercules, which was amazing, that we did recently.
Certain values of amazing.
And I wanted to pick something that was more like a thriller, that was a bit more dry, that was a bit more normal, in inverted commas. I don't think I did a particularly good job of that.
I don't think I would describe this as particularly normal, but I take your point. It's real world set.
Yes.
With a slight twist.
Yes.
In the sci-fi direction.
And it's certainly a lot more dry than I thought it
was. Oh, yeah, yes. Yes. Dry factor high.
So that was a thing. What did you think?
It really took me by surprise because you described it as an adaptation of a Stephen King movie directed by David Cronenberg, at which point I was going to veto because not my thing. Either of those people, no thank you, not me. But it really, really took me by surprise in quite a lot of ways. And I have thoughts.
Okay.
Did it hold up for you overall, apart from the dryness factor?
Yeah, I mean, there's a bit in the middle that's quite unnecessarily icky that I'm
sure.
Oh
God,
will...
yes. Oh, don't remind me. I have to talk about this later. It's so grim.
Which is a real shame because if you cut those like 10 seconds out, then you could show the entire rest of the film to like, well, I don't know, not if not children, certainly young teenagers.
Yeah.
But you'd have to cut that section out.
Yeah. And a couple of other bits.
Really?
Anyway.
Okay. And as I'm sure we may touch on later, it kind of almost felt like a TV show, the way it was shot.
Yeah, it's very weirdly structured.
It's weirdly structured, and it's partly that it's just shot in a very kind of remote, again, dry, very dry kind of way. I find it fascinating.
Quite detached.
Yes, indeed.
Detached would be a good word.
I find that it's fascinating this is coming out, you know, around the same time as things like Ghostbusters or other stuff.
It's a good point. It doesn't feel very 80s, different. Actually.
Because
you think of 80s being really over the top.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
And it's definitely not.
It
feels more 70s to me.
It does, very true. Very true. It does feel more like Invasion of the Body Snatchers or something like that. But, yeah, well, sorry, what was the actual question? What did I think? I still thought it was good. I enjoyed it.
Good. I have the world's shortest synopsis.
Go for it.
John Smith, yes really, wakes up from a coma with psychic abilities which he uses to catch a serial killer and prevent a madman from becoming president and starting World War III. And that's it.
I have thoughts about the madman bit. We'll get to that much later on.
Okay. Well, yes. So yes, that is basically it.
Yes. I mean, you might want to be a little bit more specific about the psychic abilities. He has a type of psychometry, which means that when he touches people, he sometimes gets visions of...
either the future or the past.
Yes, yes. Related to them.
Yeah.
So...
Yeah.
Should we do some quick facts?
Yes. I found it interesting that Stephen King himself wrote the original script, but it was rejected by the studio as involved and convoluted.
Well, that's kind of his writing.
Yeah, and also rejected by Cronenberg as needlessly brutal. So, wow.
Fascinating.
Yeah, because Cronenberg not, you know, known for his squeamishness.
Although his stuff, I think, got worse later, but I could be wrong.
Yeah. Well, this took me by surprise because it was almost entirely mundane and not icky at all.
Yeah,
apart from that one moment in the middle.
Mundane is a really good word to describe it, actually.
Mm.
Yeah, interesting.
But not uninvolving.
No.
And apparently, Stephen King said that the changes to the script improved and intensified the power of the narrative. I do not believe that for a minute. Any author would think that after having been rejected for screenwriting a version of his own novel.
I mean, that sounds like the kind of thing you say when you're doing the press tour to try and get people to go and see the film.
Yeah. But anyway, there you go. What have you got?
So, I have a few facts, if that's okay.
Oh, of course, because it's you.
So, came out in 1983, Stephen King wrote the novel in 1979, so bearing in mind it takes like, you know, a better part of a year to shoot a film.
Pretty
it came
quick.
Out super fast.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting because it was the first Stephen King novel to get into the top 10 bestsellers in American books.
Oh, really?
Because
I hadn't heard of it before.
Mm, but...
Not that I'm, you know, a Stephen King aficionado,
no.
But I've heard of all of the really famous ones.
But it's just super interesting that you've got this novelist who's only just starting to become really popular.
Yeah.
Goes straight to a film inside, you know, 4 years. And
yeah.
That just seems really interesting.
Yeah, speedy.
There's also a 2002 TV series.
Oh, really?
In which Nicole DeBoer, who you may know as Esri Dax from DS9,
oh, okay.
Plays Sarah. I hear it's really good. I have not seen it.
Okay.
It obviously stars Christopher Walken, who I wonder whether he's happy that these days he's best known for being in the Fat Boy Slim video rather than any of the many, many excellent films that he's been in.
It was a good video, though.
It was an excellent video. He did star in a film called Brainstorm just before this, which I have added to the list. I'm not going to make you watch it for a long time,
okay.
But it's down there somewhere, which is the only film that I've seen that is much better if you're on lots of drugs. I was not on lots of drugs. Don't do drugs, kids.
Yeah, don't do drugs.
But it is extremely trippy. But he's still doing stuff because he was in Dune 2, apparently, although I don't remember.
No.
Oh, he was the Emperor.
Oh, of course. Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I found the casting quite interesting because I don't know whether this was odd at the time, but it seemed odd to me now that Christopher Walken was the good guy and Martin Sheen was the bad guy because you would normally expect it to be the other way around.
Yeah, I'd never thought of that.
Yeah, a cheery Christopher Walken in the first couple of minutes was a very odd thing to see.
Yes. Martin Sheen had just come off doing Gandhi.
Oh, wow.
6 months previously.
Okay.
He's obviously best known for The West Wing and a bunch of other stuff. Can I keep going?
Yeah, of course.
So it was written by a guy called Jeffrey Boehm, who is best known for writing all of the Lethal Weapon films.
Oh, okay.
But he also did Innerspace, which...
Which is weird, because that and the Lethal Weapon films are very kind of upbeat and bouncy, and this is very much not. This is very flat.
So he did Innerspace that I really like. But while I was reading his Wikipedia page, I was thinking to myself, I've read this before. Why am I recalling having read this before? That's really weird. And it turns out it's because he also wrote The Lost Boys, which we did not very long ago.
Yeah, again, that is kind of 80s over-the-topness.
I wonder what year that came out, because that
can't
be...
I remember. It was 86 or 87, I think.
Yeah,
so a few years later.
So it's quite close to this, but the writing is very, very different.
Yeah. Yeah, very odd.
It was originally directed, or down to be directed, I should say, by a guy called Stanley Donen. His Wikipedia page, I won't go into the details, but he had a fascinating relationship with Gene Kelly, which went on for several decades. Quite tempestuous relationship. He also did Seven Fights for Seven Brothers. And
what?
All sorts of weirdness. But he was originally going to be the director and then not...
So, yeah, now I'm trying to imagine a Seven Brides for Seven Brothers-esque version of this, and I cannot.
Yeah, me cannot. Definitely. No, definitely not.
Okay. That would be weird.
It was directed by Cronenberg.
Yeah.
He just came off the back of a thing called Scanners, which was reasonably popular.
Which is pretty grim.
Oh, it's grim.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So all very surprising in how this turned out tonally.
It was produced by Dino de Laurentiis, who I definitely heard of, but
I know the name.
When I read his immensely long list of films that he'd produced, I'd heard of hardly any of them, despite the fact that I'd heard of him, which was quite weird. But the following year after this, he did the awesome David Lynch version of Dune, Sting in His Pants.
Certain values of awesome.
Oh, amazing. He also did Flash Gordon and various other quite silly
things. Oh, okay.
So the film made about $20 million at the box office in America and about another $15 million worldwide.
Going to have cost much to make, I wouldn't imagine.
Off the back of about $6 million to make. So
okay. Yeah, so pretty good.
A fair chunk of money. Mm-hmm. It's currently sitting at 88% fresh on Rotten Tomatoes and about 70% on Metacritic. So it's reasonably popular.
Okay. So, I want to make one very weird comparison. So, Christopher Walken in this reminded me of Charlton Heston's Moses in The Ten Commandments.
Okay, that's very weird.
Yeah.
How?
Because, much like when Moses goes up the mountain and encounters the burning bush and comes down with his hair standing on end...
Yeah.
Christopher Walken in this has his hair absolutely straight and flat onto his head mm-hmm. when he goes into the coma,
mm-hmm.
and when he comes out of the coma, it's all standing on end.
That's a really good point.
Yeah.
I mean, when he first turns up, he has this weird bowl cut.
Yeah, it was very weird. I wouldn't have recognised him if I hadn't known that it was him, but as soon as you have his hair standing on end, it's suddenly Christopher Walken somehow.
So can you describe the start of the film? What is...
So, at the start of the film, a very kind of cheery English teacher who is trying way too hard to get his students to like him goes to a theme park with his fiancée, who is also a teacher in the school. And on a roller coaster, he has a weird moment where he starts pressing his head and having odd sensory experiences and obviously isn't feeling too well. And then he takes his girlfriend home and then goes off into a growing storm to drive home. And there's an accident with a milk tanker. And then he wakes up and it's 5 years later.
So can I say a few quick things about
of course.
That bit? So, first of all, this person, who is not particularly interesting at this point, the film starts with a rendition of The Raven by Edgar Allan Poe.
Yes.
And it's the least scary telling of The Raven that I've ever heard, which is...
It's a very good point.
Quite possibly on purpose.
Well, why?
Well, to demonstrate that he's not a...
Very interesting or dynamic English teacher?
Or scary person.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So, I had a very similar thing to you that when he was on the roller coaster and pressing his fingers to his temple and doing stuff, that he suddenly looked like Christopher Walken.
Okay, I didn't get that until he woke up.
But
it is interesting because, you know, the synopsis on Wikipedia and places and in the film itself, people are going, oh, you know, this has happened subsequent or consequent to the coma. But he was having the symptoms of the headaches before that, mm-hmm. on the day of the accident.
Yeah, yeah, it's true.
So it's not due to the accident and or the coma.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But I feel slightly sorry for Christopher Walken because he doesn't look like Christopher Walken as you would expect him until he's gurning slightly.
That's a bit harsh.
And then you're like, oh, there he is.
It's interesting that it's nearly 7 minutes before the character even gets a name. And then it turns out his name is John Smith. So again, he is basically a non-entity.
Yes. I mean, he is a cipher. Yeah.
But then the girlfriend doesn't get a name until 15 minutes in.
I mean, the girlfriend is...
She's not really in it much.
She's very much a non-entity.
Yeah. Who is not a non-entity in this film? Martin Sheen. Yeah. And he doesn't turn up until like half an hour before the end.
Yeah. That
which is very weird.
Very weird.
It's structured in a very episodic way, which it did mention in the Wikipedia article was deliberate, but not why. So you have the three acts. You have the bit before the accident, which isn't very long. And then you have the section in the middle where he's discovering that he has the powers and has the case with the serial killer. And then you have the third act, which is the introduction of Martin Sheen's politician and John discovering what he's potentially going to do in the future and dealing with it. So, but they're all quite separate.
I mean, to me, it felt like a TV series. It felt like a TV series that you had where every episode was like 15 minutes long and you would...
Vision of the week.
And yeah, and you'd kind of, you know, put them all together super quick.
Yeah.
Because there's a bit, I mean, we're jumping ahead plot-wise, but there's a bit where he is being paid to tutor children because he's not a teacher anymore. And there's a whole bit where he befriends a small boy and has a vision that he's going to fall through some ice in the hockey game. And that's just, you know, another whole...
It's
very much vision of the week.
That's really important, though. There is a really important aspect to the falling through the ice thing, because that's the first time. So there's only actually... No, I was going to say... Five visions. So the first vision he has is when he's in the hospital and he touches the nurse's hand and he sees her house on fire and her daughter trapped in the house.
So just super quickly, he kind of is lying there being depressed because he's woken up and his fiancée has now married somebody else. So he's been told.
Because he's lost 5 years.
Yeah. And then the nurse comes in and is looking after him and suddenly he grabs her across the thing and I was just like... I saw it coming, but it was still a very impressive kind of jump scare. But it's also very, very tropey.
Yes, that is true. Anyway,
sorry.
My point was...
Sorry.
He sees the house on fire and he tells her to go home. But when she arrives home, the fire brigade is already there and the daughter is being carried out of the house. So nothing changes because of the vision.
I presumed that she called the fire brigade before she got in the car to go.
Oh, no, I hadn't thought of that. But no, because the whole point of... Because where I'm going with this is... it's difficult to tell because the second one is he gets a vision of the doctor's family escaping some kind of war-torn country past.
It's the Nazis.
Okay.
It's the pogrom.
And him being separated from his mother, and John tells him that his mother is still alive. So again, he's not changing events. He's seeing things that have already happened. The third time is when he identifies the serial killer. So he does actually change things there because he enables the police to catch the guy who admittedly then kills himself. But anyway, but the point about the ice is that he sees a vision of the young boy falling through the ice when he's playing hockey and potentially drowning. And he tells the boy's father, and then the boy then refuses to play ice hockey. So it's the first time where he sees something that hasn't actually happened yet, and it then doesn't happen.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's when he decides to take action to stop Martin Sheen's political career because he realises he can actually change what he sees. That what he sees doesn't necessarily come to pass because prior to that, he's only seen things that do still happen or have already happened.
So he describes it to the doctor that he's still seeing. He says, when I had the vision of the ice hockey, there was a hole, there was a dead zone with the title of the film.
And it's not really explored, it's only very briefly mentioned.
Yeah.
And it's actually a different interpretation of the title than is in the book, apparently.
Oh, okay. What's the interpretation of the book?
It's something to do with a part of his psyche that's been altered by the powers.
Oh.
So they changed it, and then they also didn't really make it a thing. So yes, it is true that it's important, because he then, that's what prompts him to take action against Martin Sheen.
Mm.
But it's only kind of like mentioned in a throwaway scene and not really dwelt on, because I actually wrote down about halfway through, what does the title mean? And then there was this scene where they explained what the title meant.
I mean, presumably because the book was really popular, if they're going to make the film, they need to give it the same name, and then they need to make it mean something. And so they had to have some throwaway line that explained what it was. And it was just, you know, the...
But it is the impetus for the climax.
Yeah, it's basically
it's
this,
just not really
this,
highlighted
this
very strongly.
This feeling that he's able to change the future in some way.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I thought that in terms of filmmaking, it's all very flat. It's interesting that it highlights yet again to me that almost every film that we would expect to see in the cinema now has the colour scale really ramped up into super unnatural level.
Yeah.
And for a lot of stuff, you know, if I'm watching Lord of the Rings or if I'm watching a science fiction epic or a Marvel thing or something, I'd expect that. But it's in everything now, because this, in comparison, felt very, very grey.
Yes.
And I'm not sure that that's necessarily deliberate. It's just filmed to be like the real world.
Mm-hmm.
And the real world is, for the most part, kind of grey. But we're not used to seeing that in the cinema anymore, and so it looks really weird. The bits that stood out that I thought were a good filmmaking were the visions. All of the vision scenes were so really good.
Yes.
So you've got the fire, you've got...
Oh, the fire was I mean, a massive traumatic moment for me, because I have this... I don't know what it is, but I have this very strong, visceral reaction against stuffed animals being abused in any way, which is utterly ridiculous. So I find it very difficult watching small children on the bus being mean to their teddy bears. And in the fire, the bunny, the stuffed bunny and the bear both bite the dust in a quite traumatic way.
Mm.
But you're not going to have anticipated that, so I don't blame you.
So the fire's really good. How they filmed that without putting the little girl in danger, and lots of very strong foreshortening, I guess, you know, very impressive. And again, how they filmed the kid falling through the ice, because he's, I don't know, 10 maybe?
Yeah, something like that.
And yet somehow they've, you know, pulled him underwater for a few seconds to do that shot. So I don't know how you do that, but it's quite impressive. And the scene for the Second World War, when they had tanks and they had a couple of buildings explode and stuff, so that's even though it was only on screen for
there was quite an amusing moment where there was an explosion,
a heck of a set,
and a soldier obviously bounced off a trampoline into the
really?
Air as he was being blown up by the explosion. It was very silly.
I did not see that.
Yeah.
Okay.
But yeah, other than that, it was pretty good.
Mm.
I mean, I have a lot of things to say about the women, and I have a lot of things to say about the ending. Do you have any more? I'm not sure I have much else to say about the middle, because, I mean, it got to, as we said, the structure was very weird. It got to there being 20 minutes left, and I had absolutely no idea where the film was going, because there weren't actually any loose ends at that point.
Mm.
The whole thing to do with Martin Sheen at the end sort of came out of nowhere.
Yeah, there was a little bit of that, wasn't there?
But did you have anything else from the middle?
Yeah, I've got a couple of bits. So
go for it.
I thought it was really interesting how he was in the press almost from the start.
Yeah, it was a bit weird because... sorry, I'm doing a U. I thought one of the things I wrote down was, it seems really odd to me that he wouldn't be inundated with people asking him to do stuff, which does happen later.
Yes.
But not until after the serial killer case, because when he wakes up and does the thing with the nurse and the doctor, so the nurse and the fire and the doctor, and saying that his mother was still alive, there's a press conference, and one of the press is being quite antagonistic towards him and goes, oh, you should, you know, give us a demonstration. And so he touches the guy's hand and he is quite aggressive back and starts talking about something to do with, do you really want me to tell you why your sister died or something?
Mm-hmm.
And there isn't really any resolution to that, and there isn't really any proper evidence, and it just kind of feels as though it was probably presented as, oh, he's just some crazy guy and it's not real.
Mm-hmm.
But then when the serial killer thing happens, mm-hmm. and he reveals that it's actually the sheriff's deputy what done it. He then moves away to a different town, and when... Is it the doctor that comes to see him?
Yes.
Says, oh, how are you doing? And he reveals this giant sack of post of all these people asking him to find things or solve mysteries and stuff, but he's just ignoring it all. So what did you mean by him being in the press?
So there's two different things about it. The first one of which is there's always a major issue about being in a fantasy setting where it's provable that supernatural things are real.
Yeah.
Because as soon as that's the case, you'd immediately be on the front page of every newspaper in the world. You'd be, you know, on TV all the time.
Mm.
You'd be whisked off by the government to a black ops place to go and, you know, interrogate spies and things.
Yeah.
So, but, yeah, obviously none of that happens. So it's partly that. It's partly that why is there even a press conference? Who called the press conference when the nurse went back to her house to find that her daughter was still okay after the fire, why then call a press thing? And why would he agree to take part?
Yeah, I don't know.
It's
weird, isn't it? I didn't really quite follow that either.
And then later on...
And the fact that he doesn't actually go anywhere.
And then later on when they... I can't remember, is it when they go to arrest the... No... There's another point in time where there's loads of press. I think, it's just after the last girl is murdered by the serial killer.
Mm.
And they turn up at this bandstand where the body
is. The crime scene, yeah.
And there's loads of press there. And I'm like, how do the press know where the body is and have got there super quick? Is there, like, you know, somebody who is calling the press and going, oh, you may want to come and rock up to this thing? I thought that was a bit odd. So that was one thing. The other thing is that there's a whole aspect which isn't really gone into about what you said about having the cupboard full of all the letters from all the people.
Mm.
And the doctor says, what's all this? And he said, people who've lost things, lost children, lost, you know, stuff, and want me to help them. And first of all, choosing not to use his power to help people, which is an interesting choice.
Well, otherwise it would take over your entire life and you'd never do anything else.
But
you can never help everybody.
Well, so that's the second thing, which is, do you sit there in despair over the fact that you can't help everybody, or do you use the power that you have to prioritise and help a small number of people?
Or do you, as he does eventually, sacrifice himself to save the entire world?
Yes, but you're not doing that knowledgeably. You don't know... When you're sitting there with your giant pile of letters, you don't know that's what's going to happen.
That's true.
So your choice is to go, I can't fix everything, therefore I'll do nothing.
Mm.
Or I'll have a go at trying to fix something. And it's not just related to him. That's a general, you know...
Yes, absolutely.
Question.
So yes, he decides to do nothing until there's a situation which prompts him into action because it's so important that he feels he needs to do something.
Yeah. So you could argue that...
So he saves the little boy because he cares about the little boy.
Yeah,
and then he tries to stop Martin Sheen from becoming president because the scale of the problem that is going to occur is so big that he can't sit idle.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. But I think my point still stands, that he's kind of, you know, deciding not to help anybody is an interesting choice.
But he decides to help the sheriff with the case, the serial killer case.
Yeah, but that's before
he's got one person who's actually coming to him and saying, I'm sitting right in front of you and I want you to come and help me out, which
is
a bit different than lots of letters.
And that's before he's gone off into the other place and gone into seclusion.
Yeah.
It's never mentioned.
Well,
it's
the reaction to suddenly being inundated.
True. Oh, yes, absolutely.
That makes him hide away.
Mm-hmm. It's also never really made clear how he's making money's do anything before.
Well, he's a tutor.
Well, at that point, but I thought it was really interesting when he's still living with his father.
Yeah, so he's staying with his dad to begin
with. When he first wakes up, his mother makes a whole load of strongly religious references.
Yes, there is a weird thing with the presentation of the older women in this.
About her saying, you know, you've been given this power by God, and then she dies almost immediately, which
yes,
is...
Yes, It is quite weird.
But that's not, sorry, but that's not the point that I'm making. When he's living with his father, if you look around, there are loads and loads of open, well, not like textbooks, and there's loads of notepads that have been written on, but there's no explanation of what that's about. And then when...
Yeah, because it's the doctor who says he's been doing research into psychic powers, isn't it?
And then when
not, there's not the sense that John's doing that.
And then after he's captured the serial killer, when he is living on his own in that place, again, loads of textbooks, loads of notepads, and a typewriter with a bunch of stuff that's been written on it.
Okay, I didn't pay attention to that. That's interesting.
And it's not mentioned what it is. In order to explain something else that's there, I kind of need to do... Can we talk about... Let's talk about Martin Sheen, because then we can come back to the
thing. What, as in actually what happens at the end?
Yeah.
So Martin Sheen is an up-and-coming politician who's running for the Senate. And he's very popular, but he's presented as being not a very nice guy because you see him engaging in blackmail and having his minion threaten people. And there's a really fantastic bit, actually, when he's first introduced. So this guy comes to Smith's house and asks him to come and tutor his son because he feels like his son isn't engaging with the world or has some kind of issue with being too shy. And he's had good reports of Smith's tutoring skills, which seems a bit odd because I wouldn't have thought there'd be, you know, that much around about his tutoring. But anyway, so he goes and meets the boy. And when he goes to the house, Martin Sheen's character, Stilton, is there being all chummy with the father of this boy. And Smith holds his hand out to shake hands with him.
Yeah.
And Martin Sheen gives him a giant badge with Vote for Stilton on it, which is a fantastic way of circumventing them touching.
Yeah.
So you know there's something going on.
Oh, okay.
That it kind of foreshadows that if they had, something would have happened, but it's kind of circumvented, which I thought was really clever because it sets it up for, oh, this is going to be a thing later on. So then he does actually touch him at a rally and he has this vision of him setting off the nuclear missiles, presumably towards Russia, for no apparent reason, because after he does it, he opens the door and his advisors are there going, oh, we found a diplomatic solution, so there's no need to worry. And he's like, aha, I've done it already. And he's all happy about it. And so Smith decides... Johnny decides that... You see, that makes me think of... what's his name from The Shining, which is also Stephen King.
Yeah.
Anyway, so John decides, because he now knows that he can change the future, that he has to do something about it. So he is going to try and assassinate Stilson at another rally.
With this massive hunting rifle.
With a massive hunting rifle.
Why does he have a massive hunting rifle?
I don't know. So he hides in the town hall up on the balcony.
He breaks in the previous night and the building is not examined by anybody because Stilson's security is non-existent.
It's rubbish! Yes, absolutely rubbish. And then he gets distracted somehow.
Yes, so he stands up in order to shoot Stilson, and because his ex-fiancée is campaigning for Stilson, and when Stilson turns up at the event, he sees her and her husband and their baby and thinks, oh, having a baby on stage is great photography for me, and invites them to be up on stage with
him. Oh, right, yes.
And then when Johnny stands up with a massive hunting rifle, his ex-fiancée goes, Johnny, what the hell are you doing?
And that's, he distracts him, and so he misses.
Yes.
And I really liked the ending, because I thought he was just going to probably get killed himself, but he would actually succeed. And then when he failed, I was like, oh my god, what's gonna happen? But of course, Stilson, being the absolute shit that he is, his reaction to someone firing a gun at him is to grab Sarah's baby and hold it up in front of him as a human shield. And so even though John doesn't actually kill him, his political career is dead, because he's photographed holding a baby up to protect himself from an assassination attempt. And I thought that was absolute genius. And then you also get the security guy, the minion goon character, who does actually shoot John.
Yeah.
Then refuses to go and find the guy who was taking the pictures so that he can stop the press from going out. So you get his kind of almost redemption arc of, okay, this guy's gone too far, I'm not going to work for him anymore. But I thought it was brilliant. It was really interesting subversion of your expectations, but still managing to achieve the effect that was desired. I thought it was great. But what was your point?
There's a few things. I am really interested how, with hardly any screen time, Martin Sheen manages to come over as bonkers.
Unhinged.
And I think he does it just by having his eyes slightly wider open than is natural every time he's on screen.
Yeah.
And it just interesting because makes him look a little crazy.
A lot of the activities that you see the character doing are similar to activities that you see the actor, the same actor doing in the West Wing. But the presentation of the characters is the complete opposite. Without that much of a change in how it's done. Yeah. So yes, very impressive.
Yeah. The point that I wanted to go back to is that when the Doctor visits Johnny in the place that he's taken himself off to get away from the press, on the wall, in the background, is a crude painting of missiles taking off.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Okay, I missed that completely.
And it's never referred to, and Johnny doesn't say, you know, I've been having dreams and I painted these things, or, you know, it's not referred to at all.
Mm.
But there's very definitely, almost like a child's painting of missiles taking off.
Right. So you'd think that if it's a childish kind of painting, it would be some of his students giving him presents of some variety, but
could be.
I don't know why that would be. Oh, the other thing that's important, actually, in terms of the two things that prompt him to do what he does at the end is, first, that he discovers that he can actually change what he sees in the visions,
mm-hmm.
and also that the Doctor tells him that he's likely dying because of the ability.
Yeah.
Because he's getting more and more headaches.
Mm.
And the suggestion is that he won't be able to survive whatever changes has happened mm-hmm. in his brain. So he knows that he's going to die anyway, essentially. So he doesn't have anything to lose in making the assassination attempt.
And at the end, he writes a letter to his ex-fiancée, who's narrated somebody else, in which he says, "You will never know why I did this thing," rather than writing...
Actually telling her it's been proven that he can see the future.
Rather than saying, "I went to shoot him because he was going to destroy the world." It's like, why would you do that?
Yeah, and if it's been proven...
Because you just, you know...
Also, if it's been proven that he does actually have accurate visions, he could have just gone to the press.
Or at least to other people and asked for how to best
influence
or deal with the problem you know, do something about it.
Oh, well.
It had never occurred to me that, yes, there would be other recourses other than shooting the guy.
Yes, in a crowd well.
Yes.
When he's not ever been established as being a good shot in any way.
Yes. Does seem to be a bit of a thing.
When also his ex-fiancée and her baby are on the stage right next to the guy.
Yes.
Anyway. I thought it was a really good ending until I started thinking about it.
Best not to do that kind of thing.
What else did you have?
I've got some random little tiny bits.
Mm-hmm. Was that what you wanted to talk about with the painting?
Painting, yeah.
Got it.
Yeah.
Okay, missed that completely.
I got some tiny bits. I thought it was interesting when they were blackmailing the... Sorry, when Stilson and his goon were blackmailing the editor of the local newspaper.
Because
they had a bunch of photos, because they'd honey-trapped him. They'd sent some woman off to go and seduce him. And I was saying to you at the time that there's all this paranoia in the press at the moment with the upcoming elections about deepfakes and creating pictures of things that haven't really happened. But you could flip it around the other way, and if people have photos of stuff that has really happened, you could just say, well, you've deepfaked that, you've just made it up.
Yeah.
And so you could do it the other way around.
Yes.
It becomes harder to blackmail people because people would say, well, if you produce those things, I'll just say that you made them up.
Potentially.
So that's
I think that interesting. The suggestion of something is always going to have an effect, even if there's a claim that it's not true. But yeah, it's difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing, the sign of the intervening times, when the ex-fiancé's husband comes to the door campaigning for Stilson, and then Sarah turns up and he sees her, he gets really upset, and afterwards the young boy he's tutoring is there and is asking him what's wrong, and he kind of like turns around and pulls him to him and
gives him a hug,
clutches him in a quite intense hug, which admittedly is what then gives him the vision of the of him falling through the ice.
Yeah.
But I have to admit that the amount of physical contact between John and the young boy, there was absolutely no suggestion of anything untoward whatsoever. But just because of all of the intervening time and all of the other things that I've seen and the presentation of that kind of thing now, it made me really uncomfortable.
See, that's really interesting, because I made a note in which I said unexpectedly wholesome.
Yeah, because in the presentation of it, it was incredibly wholesome. He was just being genuinely affectionate towards a boy that he was enjoying tutoring and had some kind of connection with and didn't have a great home life. But he did it in a very physically affectionate way, which whilst, as I say, there was absolutely no hint, no tone, no nothing to suggest there was anything untoward. I was watching it thinking, I don't know, I don't feel comfortable with how much he's touching him.
See, it's interesting.
And that's an indoctrination of that kind of thing in me, nothing to do with the film.
Yeah, it's interesting, because I was aware of the same thing, but it, instead of making me feel uncomfortable, I was thinking, I'm surprised it's not making me feel uncomfortable.
Oh, interesting.
Big spoilers for the TV series. I haven't seen it, but obviously I have read the Wikipedia page.
Oh, of course you have.
The Sarah's husband, so his ex fiance's husband, is a big major character in the TV series.
Oh, really?
And
because he's barely in the film.
And is really nice. And him and Johnny become really good mates.
Nice. I like it when that happens.
And that's a thing. And then he's horribly killed in the end of season 5.
Oh. Wow, there were 5 seasons?
Like 7, I think, something like that.
Wow, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, that's unfortunate.
So, yeah.
So the TV series is, you know, Vision of the Week. Solving problems kind of thing.
I guess?
Okay.
I don't really know. I know that Stilson's in it, but he doesn't turn up till like, season 5 or something.
Fair enough.
But, yeah, there was that.
Yeah, we haven't talked about the moment of incredible horror. Do we want to go into that or not? There's a moment of incredible horror, listeners. Maybe I shouldn't go into it because
when
we don't need to share.
When Johnny has a vision and sees who the killer is, and it's
the sheriff's deputy.
The deputy drives off and they go to his house. And
he kills himself, and let's leave it at that.
Well, hang on.
Sorry.
When they go in the house, I can't remember how, but Johnny ends up either shaking hands or in some other way touching the guy's mother and has a vision, although you don't see the vision this time. Johnny just looks at her and goes, "You knew."
Right, yes.
Which I thought was interesting.
Mm.
We don't really get to explore that at all, but I thought that was interesting. Then the guy kills himself and it's quite unpleasant.
It's very unpleasant, especially with the twitching.
Yeah, I kind of had my hand over my eyes most of
the time. Okay, that was very sensible.
And then his mother comes out with a gun and tries to shoot them. And the sheriff...
He does actually shoot John.
Oh, yes, that's true, yes. And then the sheriff...
But she just wings him.
Yeah, the sheriff shoots
Kills
her.
Kills her, yeah.
So obviously there's a fascinating relationship going on between the serial killer and his mother. We never get into it.
That brings us neatly to the women. So the women are kind of interesting, because there's really only one female character. I mean, there's the nurse, and then there are the two mothers, who are quite interesting, because they don't get names other than being Mrs. Smith and Mrs. Dodds. But Mrs. Smith, who's John's mother, turns up when he wakes up from the coma and raves about it being a miracle and a gift from God and all of this kind of stuff. And then she dies. And then Mrs. Dodds raves about him being sent from hell by the devil.
So she's the serial killer's mother.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then dies.
That's a good point.
So there's a kind of a parallel there to a certain extent.
Yeah,
but with the
that.
Opposite presentation. And then there's Sarah.
Hmm.
And I don't really understand Sarah.
Her character is kind of all over the place.
So obviously she's in a happy relationship with John at the start and is assuming that they're going to get married, and then he's in the horrible accident.
So before that happens, he drops her off at her place.
Yeah.
And it's raining and he's tired and he's, you know, been having these headaches on the roller coaster.
Mm.
And she says, you know, you could come in
and stay the night.
And, you know, it's all the eyes and the body language and stuff. And he's like, no, there are...
It's better if we wait.
There are some things that are worth waiting for.
Yes.
And then she's giving it the, are you sure, kind of whole body language thing.
Yeah.
And then, you know, so there's she's quite forward, shall we say, at that point.
So considering that 5 years later, she has a 10-month-old with her new husband.
Yes.
So they have presumably been together they've been married for more than 18 months.
Mm-hmm.
And possibly together for, let's say, a year before
beforehand.
That. If
yep.
they've, you know, moved pretty fast.
Yep.
So after her fiancé, who she was obviously crazy about at the start...
Mm-hmm.
having been in a terrible accident and her
mm-hmm.
dealing with the grief of that and him being in a coma,
mm-hmm.
she gets together with somebody else in about two to 2.5 years?
Yeah, that seems entirely reasonable to me.
Okay, fair enough. So
2 years is a long
credible.
Time when you're in your mid-20s.
True, that is true. Anyway, so she turns up and visits him and is... You know, they're quite awkward with each other, which you would be.
Yes, exactly.
And then she turns up at his parents' house where he's staying after his mum dies.
And his dad's away.
And she says, I brought you a visitor, and produces her baby out of the car as if he would be delighted
mm-hmm.
to be spending time with the son of the guy who married his fiancée.
Yeah.
Which is super weird.
I don't think that's weird. I think that's sweet.
And then she puts the baby down to sleep in the bedroom and comes back out and starts taking her clothes off.
And that is weird.
And they have sex.
She says... Do you not write down what she says?
No, what
no,
did she
I
say?
No, I didn't write it down either, but it's something like...
Haven't we waited long enough?
That's it, yes.
I mean,
yes.
What? What on earth? So they have sex.
That made no sense.
And then, of course, she makes him dinner. And his dad, because his dad comes home and goes, what have you been doing all day? And they kind of look at each other, and then she's making the dinner.
Mm-hmm.
And she's there quite late, and I'm like, where does her husband think she is?
Yeah.
And then they go outside, and he says, oh, will I see you again? And she says,
not like that.
Today.
Yes.
And I'm like, what the hell was that? That was just you had that itch from the night of the accident that you just needed to scratch once before
it's,
you then let it go?
It's sympathy.
But, I mean, I would have thought that'd be worse.
Yeah.
So I was really didn't quite know how to think about that.
Yeah, that was weird.
And then she's there when he tries to assassinate Stilson, and obviously it's her baby that Stilson
yes.
grabs to use as a human shield.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so then... He gets shot by the goon and falls off the balcony and is lying bleeding on the floor. And the film ends with Sarah throwing herself over him and sobbing about it.
Yes.
And I'm like, I don't really know what to think about that character arc.
She is all over the place.
Yeah, it was super weird.
Mm-hmm.
And she's basically the only female character in it.
Yes.
So, not great.
No. I don't know much about Stephen King's writing of female characters. I mean, I think of The Shining, female characters not great. And I think of The Green Mile, no female characters at all.
There's basically no female characters in Shawshank.
Yes, also true. So
I don't think he's great on female characters.
Doesn't sound like it, does it?
I have seen The Tommyknockers, but I don't really remember much about it.
Okay. And if you think about the girl from It.
I prefer not to think about It at all in any way ever.
Which I have... Again, I've not seen, not read, but have read the Wikipedia page and have read...
I have far more knowledge of that story than I want to.
I've read a non-trivial amount of discussion around the female character in...
Why? I mean, briefly?
So, the characters are 13, 14.
Hmm.
And they go into the sewer to try and rescue the younger brother of one of the characters who's been taken by the monster. And they decide that the monster attacks children, so the way to be safe is to not be children anymore. And there's one, and so there's one girl and like four guys, and so she says, "Why don't you all have sex with me?" And then none of us will be children anymore. We'll all be adults, and then the monster won't get us.
Oh my god! No, I didn't know about that.
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, also not great.
Yeah.
Other diversity, there isn't any. It's 100% white.
I mean, it is not just that none of the major characters are white.
There's actually not even in the crowd scenes. So I don't think.
Incredibly weird that there are no non-white people in any of the crowd scenes.
Yeah.
To a point where that almost feels deliberate.
Mm.
It's just really weird. If you think about other films that have been taking place at the time, even ones that don't have non-white main characters, you'd still have
stuff in extras.
If you put out a general casting call for 50 people to stand in a crowd in America, they're not all going to be white.
No.
Even if you just picked people at random.
No.
And
agreed.
So
it was quite weird.
It just feels really weird, almost like a statement of some kind. It's bizarre.
Yeah, especially by the mid-80s.
Yeah, yeah, it was just weird.
And there's no other kind of diversity.
No. Well...
Well, there's really bad representation of how, after a traumatic brain injury and a 5-year coma, you would use crutches.
And a walking stick.
Because...
Christopher Walken develops a very... Ministry of Silly Walks type of walk, yeah.
Because in that situation, you would walk normally, but incredibly slowly using the crutches to help support you, not jump several feet with every step, balancing on the crutches and swinging your legs through.
Yeah.
Anyway, that stood out to me. So yes, not great disability representation, if I'm honest.
Yeah. And you would have thought there would be more mental health related stuff from how Johnny's reacting to the headaches and the stuff, but there isn't.
There really isn't, no.
So.
Apart from him disappearing off to another town and locking all of the requests for help in a cupboard.
Well, there is that.
Okay.
Right. So, I guess that wraps up our discussion of The Dead Zone, and we can move to the ratings. Regular listeners will know that we have a 5-star rating system. And half stars are allowed. So what do you think?
So I wrote down 3.5 stars, possibly 4 for the ending.
Really?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I think given our discussion, I'm going to drop it back to the 3.5. But I still thought it was pretty good.
Okay.
How about you?
See, I, up until this very moment, have never actually thought about the thing. So I'm going to do it on the fly. I think...
We're so well prepared.
Yes. I think 3...
Okay.
I think.
That seems fair.
I think it, interestingly, it feels like it would have played out much better as a TV series. And there was a TV series. Mm. And I'm told the TV series is really good.
Okay.
But I have no desire to watch the TV series because I don't want to watch something where I get to like one of the characters who's then horribly killed at the end of season 5. So.
Yes, I can see that. Oh well. If we knew, then we wouldn't like him. We wouldn't. Get to like it. Anyway, we'll think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, biggest question of all, did you still love it?
I mean, it was good. You know, I wouldn't go around saying it was the best thing ever, and I wouldn't, you know, recommend it to people in the same way that I would say, you must watch Hercules!
Yes.
But it
took me by surprise.
It was fine.
I enjoyed it more than I thought.
Okay.
Particularly liked the end.
So, what's next?
Oh, so next month we are going in a completely different direction again. In a recent pub quiz that we attended with our friend Gavin, who was on the last but one episode talking about Gremlins, one of the answers to the pub quiz questions was a film which it turned out you had never seen, and this must be corrected as soon as humanly possible. So we're going to do cool runnings.
Oh, awesome. Excellent.
So yes, I shall look forward to that. And that's it for this month's episode of Will You Still Love It Tomorrow? Many thanks to Cambo for our theme music, and thank you so much for listening. If you like the show, please rate and review it wherever you get your podcasts.
And remember, as always, if you have any comments or want to tell us about a time when you shared some media that you love, and whether or not you still loved it afterwards, you can always email us at willyoustillloveit@gmail.com.
We'd love to hear from you. You can also buy our merch at bit.ly/loveittomorrowpodcast with hyphens where the spaces should be. Please join us next month to find out what Dave thinks of cool runnings.
And whether or not Annie still loves it after our discussion.
Bye for now.